Well, good evening. It's time for us to go ahead and get started. I asked Jeff Loving if he would kick us off with a word of prayer here.
Thank you for this country, for the freedoms we have. We pray, Father, that we can take this and evangelize in every corner of this globe. Every place we carry, everybody we come in contact with that wants to listen, that we don't have any fear to proclaim your word. Thank you for all that you've given us, especially the sacrifice of your son, Jesus Christ. It's in his name we pray. Amen.
Thank you, Jeff. So we're on week 8 of our study of Jesus' last days in Jerusalem. As you recall, Jesus has come in to Jerusalem on what we like to call that Palm Sunday. He comes in, and in less than a week, he's going to be crucified. So what are the last things that he does during this time? He spends a lot of his time in the temple. He spent a couple chapters talking with the Pharisees and then about the Pharisees. And he also spent some time talking about his return. And we're going to finish up this week. Jesus is going to tell some parables, actually, about his return. So to rehash real quick, last week we finished what's commonly known as the Olivet Discourse. That's Jesus discussing the end times of both Jerusalem and of the world itself with his disciples on the Mount of Olives. And we talked about it's a difficult passage to interpret and to figure out exactly what Jesus is talking about when, but we do know some basic things about it. Jesus didn't want us to be misled by people claiming that Jesus had already come back and we'd missed it. That was one thing he was very concerned about. Jesus, when he comes back, everybody's going to see him. There will be no doubt. There will also be no more unbelievers at that point as well. And we also see that no one really knows when Jesus is going to come back. As a point of fact, at this point, Jesus himself doesn't even know when he's there. So something that we have to keep that in mind. And then we get into the parables. And I don't know about you, but after kind of studying this dense text, parables are like a breath of fresh air, aren't they? The application is simple. The interpretation is much more straightforward. And I just, doing the studying for this, I've really come to appreciate that Jesus teaches us in parables because they're very accessible. And like I said, it's kind of like a breath of fresh air after going through the Olivet Discourse there. So we're going to get into, Jesus tells four parables about his return. So he's had this long discourse about it with his disciples, but now he's going to break it down for them. He's going to make it simpler for them. He's going to make it more applicable for them. He's going to tell some stories that are going to help them understand. And the four parables are the faithful servant, which we covered last week, and then we're going to cover this week the 10 virgins, the parable of the talents, and the parable of the sheep and the goats. And all these parables are going to have common themes. One, Jesus is coming back, and we don't know when he's coming back. Two, we have things to do before he gets back. You ever heard the saying, act busy, Jesus is coming? He's going to tell us some things like that. And we're also going to see there's this concept over and over again through these parables that there is a judgment at his return. He wants us to understand these things. So we hit on this last week, and I wanted to show this slide again before we launch into talking about the 10 virgins, about first century Jewish weddings. So first century Jewish weddings are very different than our weddings today. Then the whole process of getting married is very different. So today, you know, what's the first stage? I guess that's the hunt. That's what I always tell people Abby did to me. She hunted me down. She captured me. That's right, Lily. She did. She did. I tried to get away and move cities, but she followed me. She tracked me. But they have this dating period, right? And we try to meet somebody. We try to go out with them and figure out, is this someone I could see building a life with? Well, that's not how it worked back then, right? Somebody sat down and tried to figure out who you should build a life with, but it wasn't you. It was mom and dad, and maybe the grandparents. And sometimes those families didn't even know what the kid was going to look like when they got older, male or female. But they knew that family was a family that they wanted to align with. And so you would see that kind of thing happen a lot. And it ends up being more of, we talk about marriage as a contract. But for them, it really was a contract, and they looked at it that way. And in some ways, we need to remember that when we read what Paul teaches about marriage and love. It's a very different thing for them back then. But we see that they have this contract they're going to enter into called the ketubah. I'm probably pronouncing that incredibly wrong. But at that point, the father of the bride has signed something where he's going to agree to let his daughter marry the man. Then the bride has the option at this point to accept or not accept that groom. And she'll offer him, or rather he will offer her something, sometimes rings, sometimes it was a cup of wine. And by accepting those things, she accepts him and his offer of marriage. And at that point, we might call it a betrothal, but they really are legally married at this point. And this is the situation we see Joseph and Mary in, is that they're really married. They can't go off and break that off. We hear about people breaking off engagements now, right? Engagement is, in a way, is just a promise to marry somebody. We're past that point once this contract is signed. They're married, they just haven't consummated the relationship yet. And so the bride is going to wait because she can't just go live in, I guess, the parents' basement, what we might say today, because that's all the groom has to take her back to. So the groom has to go back and prepare a place. And once the groom has prepared a place, only then is he allowed, basically, to come back and collect his bride. Now, the bride doesn't know exactly when that's going to be. It's not something that's super scheduled out in terms of, you know, you can say it's March 10th. No, it's when he gets it ready and when he makes his way over in the city. And there would be bridal parties that would come both with the groom during this time, but also with the bride. The bride would have their own bridal party. And those brides, the bride would always keep things with her just to be ready, just in case. And the bridal party would actually have to stay close by. So you can see this marriage process is very involved. It involves a lot of people. And there's a lot of uncertainty in the timing of it. It's not like I got an invitation that said, you know, save the date. March 10th, you better be there on that day. That's not the way it works. So it's a very different thing, and we need to understand that. So when the bride is waiting, the groom comes, and the groom announces himself as he's approaching, usually with a horn blast, with a trumpet blast, something they would call a shofar is what they're going to use back then. It's kind of the ram's horn. And we'll talk a little bit more about shofars later on in the quarter. But once the groom gets there, certain parts of Palestine seem to have different traditions. Either they would consummate the relationship there and then go to the father's house, or they would take the bride back to the father's house and they would consummate the relationship there. And then at that point, they enter into a celebration. The celebration is going to last for a long time. This is a several-day celebration. And so we also see there at the end, in the celebration, there's a tradition called the Kiddush. And the Kiddush, is a part of that tradition is to bless a cup of wine, and both of them are going to drink from that cup. And so we're going to see Jesus making the analogy here back again to the church being his bride. And we see this in several different places. Paul does this in 2 Corinthians 11, in Ephesians 5, and Romans 7. And Jesus does this several times in the Gospels. The church is the bride. And so that is our setup as we launch into the parable of the 10 virgins. So let's read Matthew chapter 25, verses 1 through 13. Then the kingdom of heaven will be comparable to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish, and 5 were prudent. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the prudent took oil and flask along with their lamps. Now while the bridegroom was delaying, they all got drowsy and began to sleep. But at midnight, there was a shout, "Behold the bridegroom, come out to meet him." Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. The foolish said to the prudent, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the prudent answered, "No, there will not be enough for us and you too. Go instead to the dealers and buy some for yourselves." And while they were going away to make the purchase, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the wedding feast, and the door was shut. Later the other virgins also came, saying, Lord, open up for us." But he answered, "Truly I say to you, I do not know you. Be on the alert then, for you do not know the day or the hour." And so in this analogy, if the church is the bride of Christ, in a way, we're the bridal party. And the bridegroom here is not on their schedule, right? They went at a time they probably didn't need the lamps, right? So they're waiting. It's daylight. They don't need these lamps. Five of them take oil just in case. Five of them just have the lamps. They're not really as prepared as they should be. And again, the bridegroom comes at a time that is unexpected. And so if we're the bridal party, if the church is the bridal party, it stands to reason that they are wise and foolish members of Christ's bridal party today. The wise are prepared for the bridegroom, even if it takes a while. And the foolish aren't prepared for him to come if it's not on their schedule. And that's something we need to consider in our own lives. Are we wise or are we foolish in the bridal party of Christ, in his church? Are we going to be okay if Jesus comes now? Or if Jesus comes next Saturday after what I did Friday night? Or do we need to wait, Jesus, please come Sunday directly after morning services because I'm okay then? Is that the way it's going to be? So we also see when the bridegroom arrives, the wise can't help the foolish, or they're unwilling to. And it looks like to me that they just can't, because if they give their oil to the foolish, they won't have enough oil for themselves. So what does this tell us about when Jesus comes back? What's that? Got to be ready? Absolutely. There is an individual responsibility. Just because you're part of the bridal party doesn't mean you're ready for him to come back. Just because you're here tonight on a Wednesday in a pew, just because you're here with everybody else doesn't mean that you're ready. It doesn't mean that you're ready. And it also means for those of us, we can't wait to help those. If we think we're the wise party and not the foolish party, we can't wait to help the foolish. Because by the time it's too late, by the time that trumpet blast sounds, nothing we can do. There's nothing we can do. And we also see that when the bridegroom arrives, it's too late for those who were foolish not to bring oil to go out. They try, right? They try. They go out and they try to buy oil, but it's too late. It's too late at that time. So we don't know the day or the hour. Yes, sir. There's certainly more to do than just joining the family, right? And we'll see this in the other parables. Miss Phyllis, I love your analogy. You talked about being saved by Christ is like hitting a home run in baseball. Great. Go back to the dugout, right? You're done. If you go back out to the dugout, well, I don't know. What even happens then? I don't even know. No one would ever do that, right? Because you run the bases. You still have to run the bases. If you just simply run the bases, you get that run, you get that score. But you can't just hit the home run and head back to the dugout. You've got to run the bases. So how can we prepare for something we have no idea when it'll happen? What does this mean for us in our lives? Because this is an important concept Jesus wants us to get. What does this mean for us? Have to be always prepared. That's tough to do, isn't it? How can we do that? How can we always be prepared for something? Right. think that's a great observation. We can't just show up and say, this Jesus thing is too hard. I can't follow him. Forget it. We can be prepared. We do see that. I think that's a great observation. And also that we should look at the other people around us. And we should surround ourselves with people who can help us realize that. Absolutely. Absolutely. Anything else before we go on? Yes, sir. And that's hard work, isn't it? Even sometimes we have other things in our life that are much less important than our walk with God, like our jobs or school, or whatever our hobbies are, and we will make time for those. We will be on time for work. We will stay late for work. But when it comes time to put in extra effort to serve God, we make excuses. And I wonder if it's that's because we view it as something we can procrastinate. And we know God will just forgive us if we repent later. And that's an attitude that's dangerous. It's dangerous for our hearts, and it's dangerous for our salvation, I think. So, all right, let's go on to the parable of the talents here. So Jesus continues here again. All these parables, remember, these are coming after the Olivet Discourse, after discussing the end of time and the end of Jerusalem. So beginning in verse 14, and we'll read through verse 30. For it is just like a man about to go on a journey who called his own slaves and entrusted his possessions to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, each one according to his own ability. And he went on his journey. Immediately the one who had received the 5 talents went and traded with him and gained 5 more talents. In the same manner, the one who had received the 2 talents gained 2 more. But he who received the 1 talent went away and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. Now after a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. The one who had received the 5 talents came up and brought 5 more talents, saying, Master, you entrusted 5 talents to me. See, I have gained 5 more talents. His master said to him, well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. Also, the one who had received the 2 talents came up and said, Master, you entrusted 2 talents to me. See, I have gained 2 more talents. His master said to him, well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. And the one also who had received the 1 talent came up and said, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow, and gathering where you scattered no seed. And I was afraid, and I went away and hid your talent in the ground. See you have what is yours. But his master answered and said to him, you wicked, lazy slave, you knew that I reap where I did not sow, and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have put my money in the bank, and on my arrival, I would receive my money back with interest. Therefore, take away the talent from him and give it to the one who has the 10 talents. For to everyone who has more, or to everyone who has, more shall be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who does not have, even what he does have shall be taken away. Throw out that worthless slave into the outer darkness. In that place, well, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So the master leaves his slaves with his possessions. I want us to stop and think about this, because we can read past this, and I have until I studied again for this lesson, that the master leaves his servants with his possessions. Does this sound like a bad master? Does this sound like a bad guy to work for? He's entrusting his servants, his slaves, with responsibility and with a good deal of physical wealth. something we need to think about here as we read this. This is not a master who left them in poverty and said, well, I hope the food lasts till I get back. He left them with an abundance to take care of themselves, and he left them with the means to work for themselves until he came back. I think that tells us something about the nature of our master as well, doesn't it? It's that God hasn't left us destitute here with nothing to do, with no skills. God has left us here with what we need, and he's also given us things to use. So what does our master expect us to do with our gifts? Who had Romans 12, 6 through 8? Is that you, Jack?
12, 6 through 8. We have different gifts according to the grace given to each of us. If your gift is prophesying, then prophesy in accordance with your faith. If it is serving, then serve. If it is teaching, then teach. If it is to encourage, then give encouragement. If it is given, then give generously. If it is to lead, do it diligently. If it is to show mercy, do it cheerfully.
What is Paul saying God expects us to do with our gifts? First thing is, we got to recognize what our gifts are, right? We got to be self-aware enough to know what we're good at and what we should leave to somebody else. Because there are some things some of us just aren't talented at. And that's okay, isn't it? The hand can't say to the foot that I don't need you. That's what Paul says, right? Ecclesiastes 9:10 says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. I see that as kind of what Paul's saying here. He's saying, if you're good at giving, give away. If you're good at teaching, teach away. And there are lots of things we can say I'm not good at, but everybody always has something that they can excel at. You can't step back and say, I'm not talented. God didn't leave me here with anything. That's not true. And if you want to be good at something that you're not good at, that's great. Paul says to eagerly desire the greater gifts. So if you want to do something else, that's great, but you've got to work at it. And that's something that God does expect of us. But we also see that there's three levels of gifts. There's high, medium, and low gifts, right? There's the five talents, the two talents, and the one talent. Does God operate this way with us today? I think he does. Some people are really talented. And we have some people in this congregation that are really talented. And there's some people in the world that maybe the best they can ever hope for professionally is manual labor, or is something that maybe our society looks down on. But everyone always has something to do. Now, the flip side of that is, are there three levels of expectations from God? Who's got Luke 12, 47 through 48? What did Jesus say? Are there different levels of expectation? Seems like there are. That those of us who have been blessed, we are expected to use those blessings. So what are the blessings we have? Everybody's got one in this room. We're Americans, right? We have the freedom to worship. Everybody in this area, we're blessed. This is not an economically depressed area. We have a nice climate. We have lots of jobs here. Those things are things that we're going to be, I believe, called to account for. How did we use those? Maybe even the time of creation that we live in, that we have the internet, that we have telephones, that we have cars. Are we going to be called to account in a way? Did you use these blessings that we have because we live now? Did we use those for God, or did we just enjoy them for ourselves? What about the fact we have the written word in front of us, like we talked about, Floyd? Well, you have the written word. A lot of people throughout history haven't had access to the written word. Have we been using that? I wanted to read an excerpt from a book by C.S. Lewis. He says this: "There is either a warning or an encouragement here for every one of us. If you are a nice person, if virtue comes easily to you, beware. Much is expected to those, or from those to whom much is given. If you mistake for your own merits what are really God's gifts to you through nature, and if you are contented with simply being nice, you're still a rebel. And all those gifts will only make your fall more terrible, your corruption more complicated, your bad example more disastrous. But if you are a poor creature, poisoned by a wretched upbringing in some house of vulgar jealousies and senseless quarrels, saddled by no choice of your own, with some loathsome perversion nagged day in and day out by an inferiority complex that makes you snap at your best friends, do not despair. He knows all about it. You are one of the poor whom he blessed. He knows what a wretched machine you are trying to drive. Keep on. Do what you can. One day, perhaps, in another world, but perhaps far sooner than that, he will fling it on the scrap heap and give you a new one. And then you may astonish us all, not least yourself, for you have learned your driving in a hard school. Some of the first will last, some of the first will be last will be first, and some of the first will be last." I think this is especially a lesson for those of us who have been blessed to have grown up around the church. We've been blessed with the opportunity to learn, to study, and yet I find myself, and I'm in this group, that I don't have a fire that a lot of people who haven't grown up that way have had. And that's a responsibility that I bear. And I don't do some of the work that some people who maybe came to Christ later in their lives, after they've lived a life of sin for a while. You know, Jesus does talk about those who have been forgiven much, love much. I think sometimes we forget how much we've been truly forgiven if we've been around the church for a while. It's certainly something I think Jesus wants us to think about in this parable. So we also see that the master is going to reward his slaves that used what was entrusted them to gain. And the slave with one talent, he doesn't throw his talent away, right? He doesn't gamble it away. He doesn't spend it on vice like the prodigal son does. He just sits on it. He just goes and buries it. And I think the analogy for us today is that he would sit in his pew and he would show up on Sunday, right? That's not enough for Jesus. Jesus wants us to use the gifts that we've given all the time, and we have to use them to gain. We can't just use them to sit on them. But why doesn't he use his gift? Why doesn't he use his gift? What does he say he is? He's scared. He's scared of his master. Is that okay that he's scared? Is that okay for us to be scared of God? What's the beginning of wisdom? Fear. So the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Should we stop at the beginning of wisdom? No. No, we want, as parents, we understand that. We want our kids to fear us when they're young, right? But we don't always want them to be scared of us, right? We want them to grow past that. However, sometimes we do need them to be afraid of us. There is also that. But should the slave have been afraid? Should a humble fear. Humble fear. So that would be, what would characterize a humble fear, you think? So it's kind of the fear that as long as I'm doing right, I have nothing to fear. But if I'm transgressing, yeah, maybe it's a righteous fear out of humility that you're greater than me, and I know I'm supposed to be doing what you've asked me to. Okay. Maybe that's what we want our kids to have, a loving fear of us, right? I do love that even after I've disciplined my children, they want to hug me for comfort. I don't understand that, but I really appreciate it. Because I don't remember feeling that way about my parents. Probably because I remember when I was older getting punished. But I that's so precious that when we punish our children, they want to hug us for comfort, and they'll actually accept it. You know, maybe that's the way God wants us to be. So what does God think of fear as an excuse for not serving him. What does he think of that? What does the master think of that? It's unacceptable, right? Let's read these two verses. Deuteronomy 31:6 and then Revelation 21:8. I'm pretty sure I passed those out. Anybody have the Deuteronomy one? Okay. And then Revelation 21:8. What translation was that, Chris? So the New American Standard says the cowardly in that list as well. So I think we see here, first of all, God doesn't want us to be afraid, right? He's telling the Israelites there in Deuteronomy, be strong and courageous, do not be afraid. I'm going to go with you. I'll be with you. And then we also see in Revelation, John is writing that cowards end up being cast out with these other groups that we would really not want anything to do with liars. That's the one we always remember Revelation 21:8 for liars. But cowards are in there too, people who are afraid. God doesn't want us to be afraid. He doesn't want us to be afraid. But will he be upset if we try to use our gifts for him and we fail? 1 Corinthians 3:6 through 7. So whose job is it to make sure that the work that we do produces fruit? It's God's. If we think that what we do causes anything, that's arrogance. God is the one that's giving the increase. We're just planting and watering. That's our job. If it doesn't work out, maybe it's because God has a better, bigger plan that we don't quite understand. How many of us have been in that situation where we wanted something to work out and it didn't, and that hurt us, and we prayed for it for a long time? And then later on, we've looked back and said, whew, sure glad God didn't answer that prayer. Or, yeah, I see God was working on something bigger here. That happens to us if we're willing to go back and examine things. Matthew 10:16, who has that one? So yes, it is God's responsibility to give the increase. But he doesn't want us to just waste our time, right? We're not supposed to go do things that are ridiculous or that make no sense and say, I did it for God. He wants us to be shrewd as serpents and to be innocent at the same time. But if we're trying to be shrewd as serpents, and if we try something and we fail, or if we try something and the return is marginal or we don't get anywhere, at least we put that talent on loan with the money lenders and we returned interest for it. At least we tried something. It would be interesting to ask Jesus, well, Jesus, what would have happened if that guy with five talents came back with three because, you know, he took a risk and it didn't pay off? I wonder what Jesus would have said. That would be interesting. I imagine it would be, what's that? Well, that depends on how we define failure. If failure is numbers, if failure is dollars, we can, right? But if the failure is growing, I don't know if we can fail. That's a good point, Brian. So what truly upsets the master is if we don't try or if we quit trying. ways, that old term, leap of faith, it really is a leap sometimes because we don't see where we're going to land. And that's tough because we like to know what's going to happen, or at least I do. And so I think that's an excellent point, Floyd, that it does take faith to use the gifts that we've given. Ms. Phyllis. Does come back a little bit to what we were talking about with Brian with that metric. What is our metric of success? And if we have that worldly metric of success, maybe we'll look at a failure when it really was a success. Valerie? Having that heavenly perspective. I think that's an excellent point. If you couldn't hear Valerie, she said that the return is back to the master. It's not for the servant to keep. And so if we expect the return to be, I get a higher salary, or I get a nicer car or a nicer house or more friends or, you know, whatever the case might be, we're looking for the wrong return. The return should be something for God. Ms. Dottie? Talk about casting your bread upon the waters, right? Absolutely. So, Ms. Phyllis, do you have something else? Almost all of Christianity is a heart thing, isn't it? Because if we fix our heart, the overflow, our mouth speaks, and then our actions, our whole lives end up being filled. Thank you very much for your comments. We'll pick up and finish the parables here next week. Thank you very much.